You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Remember the duo Peter and Gordon, who had a slew of hit records in the wake of the Beatles' British invasion of American radio? Their first hit was written by Lennon and McCartney. It was called World Without Love. But the record that made Peter and Gordon one of my favorites was this one, I Go to Pieces.
When I see her coming down the street, I get so shaky and I feel so weak. I tell my eyes look the other way, but they don't seem to hear a word I say. And I go to pieces and I wanna hide, go to pieces and I almost die every time my baby passes by. I tell my arms they'll hold someone new, another love that will be true. But they don't listen, they don't seem to care. They reach for her, but she's not there. And I go to pieces and I wanna hide, go to pieces and I almost die every time my baby passes by. I remember what she said when she said goodbye, baby. We'll meet again soon, maybe. But until we do, all my best to you. I'm so lonely, think about her only. I go to places we used to go, but I know she'll never show. She hurt me so much inside, now I hope she's satisfied. And I go to pieces and I wanna hide, go to pieces and I almost die every time my baby passes by. Go to pieces and I cry every time my baby passes by.
That was I Go to Pieces, a top 10 hit for Peter and Gordon in 1964.
My guest is Peter Asher. He was the Peter of Peter and Gordon, and he is the brilliant record producer behind Linda Ronstadt, James Taylor, and many others. Peter Asher has written a delightful new book about the Beatles called The Beatles from A to Z, an alphabetical mystery tour. Peter Asher, Peter Asher, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
You know, Peter Asher, I think this is the 45,000th book about the Beatles, but it's something that almost every other Beatle book isn't, which, besides being the only one written by you, it is, like the Beatles themselves, really funny.
Oh, good. Oh, that's good to hear.
How did you come up with your approach?
Well, it began as part of my radio show. You know, I do a weekly show on Sirius XM on the Beatles channel called From Me to You, and as part of that, I decided to do this series of shows, The Beatles from A to Z, essentially just looking for a new way to approach things and stealing an idea from Sesame Street, you know? So taking a letter each week and using it not only to choose song titles that began with that letter, but people and places and musical instruments and musical styles and all that kind of thing. So it's... And then when I finished that series of 26 radio shows, I got a call from this publisher, Henry Holt, who said, we've been listening to your shows, we really like them, we think that would make an excellent book. And I kind of went, oh, well, there's an idea, that's interesting. And first of all, of course, I thought, oh, it's going to be pretty easy because you just transcribe everything you said on the radio, and there's your book. And of course, when you do that, the tragedy is that it's pretty awful because the way you talk on the radio is different, you know. I still tried to keep it all conversational, but I realized that, you know, I would have to rewrite it substantially and that I'd have to go into greater detail about the music in particular, because on the radio, rather obviously, you get to actually play the track you're talking about. In the book, you don't. So, and while it might be fun to go through with Spotify on one hand and the book in the other, essentially the book has to stand on its own. So I found myself going into greater musical detail and a bit more actual musical analysis of each song that I talked about for the book. So it did end up being, you know, a complete rewrite, and which I enjoyed doing, but it was quite challenging and took a bit of time. But it did eventually all get done, and that's why, you know, as you may know, the book actually comes out today. So with any luck, we'll see what everybody thinks.
Well, I love the way you put, you know, musical appreciation into the book and talk about the way the songs are structured and played. And now, of course, when I listen to the Beatles, I can always tell who's singing. But can you always tell who's playing what?
Not always, no. And in some cases, you know, there's some dispute. I mean, there are people who are super expert at that stuff, which I am not. You know, I rely on the experts, Mark Lewison and all those people who've done detailed research of which sessions were on which days and which songs they did which takes of and all that stuff. I'm not that kind of expert at all, though I admire and love all the work that's been done. But as I understand it, in some cases, there are still discussions about who played what. And it's not as if one could assume that even if the Beatles themselves could remember, it would be right, you know, because I know that when I think back about records I made all that time ago, you know, because someone said, oh, on this particular Linda Ronstadt record, who played which bit? And I have to, you know, get the record out and listen carefully and remember back to the day I was in the studio producing it and try and figure that out. So some of these things may in the end end up shrouded in the mists of time, being a little mysterious. But I mean, often I can tell, but I'm just saying, can I in every case define who's playing what? Not necessarily.
There's this wonderful new film, which is called Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice. It's such a great documentary, and you're a part of it.
It's really good. I was so excited to see that, and I had nothing to do with the making of it, of course, other than, you know, being in it to whatever degree they wanted, but I think it's terrific, and, you know, I see Linda often, and I remain the world's biggest fan. She's an amazing woman and the finest singer in the universe.
No, it's a great film. And you talk about, in the film, the Beatlesque moment in the record You're No Good, where I think it's Andrew Gold who does such a perfect Beatles impression of all the different Beatles.
That's right. Working on that, creating this huge kind of guitar festival in the middle of the song. And Linda's initial reaction was admittedly to wrinkle her nose at us and kind of go, yeah, sounds like the Beatles, I don't like it. And we said, well, yes, it does sound like the Beatles, but we think it's pretty cool. And she came around completely, but she was expecting something completely different than this Beatlesque, you know, edifice that we constructed. But in the end, she came around and liked it, and luckily so did everyone else, and it became a big hit record.
Andrew Gold, he was very talented at doing those. I mean, he even plays the drums like Ringo. Or is it him playing the drums on that thing?
Yes, it is. Yes. He played most of the instruments on that track, and yes, he was an extraordinarily talented and brilliant guy. You know, I got to work with him some more, and I produced that single Lonely Boy that we did.
Oh, yeah, great. From his second album, right?
Yeah, What's Wrong With This Picture was the name of the album, yes. Yeah. And he was amazing, you know, and I miss him very much.
Let's listen to that record from 1975, Lonely Boy, by the late Andrew Gold, produced by my guest, Peter Asher.
Thank you.
Lonely Boy from 1975 by the late Andrew Gold. That record was produced by my guest, Peter Asher. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we'll be back with more of our conversation with Peter Asher right after this. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with Peter Asher. He is the Peter of Peter and Gordon. He was the record producer behind the brilliant hits of James Taylor and Linda Ronstadt and many others, and he's just written a marvelous Beatles book called The Beatles A to Z, An Alphabetical Mystery Tour.
You're very appreciative in The Beatles from A to Z, Peter Asher, of Ringo as a drummer, and I think people just sort of take it for granted, but you think he was really a fine drummer.
I do, because he was an incredibly creative drummer. I mean, there's other people who could beat him, you know, when it came to an actual, like, drum battle of any kind, you know, in terms of showing off what you can play. But in terms of creating the right drum part for the song and playing it exactly the way it needed to be played, I think Ringo is unbeatable. And I do think people tend to disregard that a bit. You know, he's an unassuming drummer. He never took big flashy solos. His fills were never kind of crazy, you know, extravagant fills. They tended to be an almost designer fill to fit that particular spot in a careful way. And that's an admirable and not always easy thing to do.
And he has a specific style because he's left-handed?
Yes, because he's left-handed and mostly playing a kind of a kit that's mostly assembled as if it were a right-handed player. He doesn't play a complete mirror image drum kit like many left-handed drummers do. So his instinct is occasionally to hit the drums in a kind of different order than somebody more conventional might do.
With Tell Me Why, a song from A Hard Day's Night, featuring some great drumming from Ringo Starr. My guest is Peter Asher. He's the author of The Beatles from A to Z.
And what about Paul McCartney's bass playing? I think he's probably the greatest bass player in history.
No question. No question about it. I mean, because it's a combination of, you know, he can play intense, simple rock and roll bass when the occasion demands it. But given the right spot and the right inspiration, he will come up with a melodic fill. You know, quite some of the deedle-la-deedle-la, you know, actual, they're almost classical in their elegance. And he plays them with a fluidity and precision that's rare. He's a, you know, as a musician, he's just a freak. He's one of those people who can pick up any instrument and play it. And he's a great drummer. He's a great pianist. He's, you know, he's unbelievable.
Well, I really want to hear the demo recording that Paul made for you of World Without Love. I want to hear it so bad.
Oh yeah, I mean yes, absolutely. It's terrific. You know, I play it at most of my shows and stuff because people are interested in it. And it's very short, of course, because at that stage the song only had two verses. You know, and I mean, so all he did the demo of is one verse and gave me the lyrics to both verses. It didn't have the bridge, and he wrote that only when Gordon and I got a record deal and Paul agreed that we could try our version of this. It's what it was essentially at that point, a reject, an orphan song without a home, because John Lennon didn't think it was right for the Beatles. He thought the opening lyric in particular was a bit ridiculous. The idea of a song that started off saying, "Please lock me away," inspired John to reply, "Yes, I will, the song's over."
Well, your harmonies are so marvelous on that record. Tell us a little bit about recording World Without Love.
Oh, that's interesting. Thank you that you say that. It is unusual because, you know, we do the first verse in unison, and then the second verse goes into harmony, but I'm actually singing the melody, which I think that's about the only time we ever did that. Because customarily, of course, the high part, me, is usually above the melody. I mean, traditionally a third above, like all the Everly Brothers records we know and love so much. And, of course, we were trying to sound as much like the Everlys as we possibly could. But when we worked out World Without Love, we found that there really wasn't a correct or great-sounding harmony part above the melody. So Gordon drops down underneath me on the second verse, and I stay where I am, which is unusual. And that did take a little bit of figuring out, but it seemed to work.
Please lock me away, and don't allow the day here inside. Where I hide with my loneliness, I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love. Birds sing out of tune, and rain clouds hide the moon. I'm okay, here I'll stay with my loneliness. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love. So I wait, and in a while I will see my true love smile. She may come, I know not when. When she does, I'll know. So baby, until then, lock me away, and don't allow the day inside where I hide with my loneliness. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love. When she does, I'll know. So baby, until then, lock me away, and don't allow the day here inside where I hide with my loneliness. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love.
World with Without Love, featuring my guest, Peter Asher, and his partner, Gordon Waller.
And you made so many great records together. Were you good friends?
Yeah, we were. I mean, we had the occasional rows, but I think duos do that. We certainly never reached the Everly Brothers level of, you know, giant hatred and
throwing your guitar down and walking.
Murder attempts. we were friends. And then, you know, when we gradually stopped playing together, we never, in fact, broke up. It was never like a, that's it, you know, we're never doing anything. We drifted into other things. I wanted very much to be a record producer, and Gordon wanted to make some records on his own, so we just drifted apart and didn't see a whole lot of each other in the interim, till to our surprise, we got back together again for a while 27 years later.
Well, let's listen to another one of Peter and Gordon's great hits. This one is Lady Godiva.
A beauty queen, she made a ride that caused a scene in the town. Her long blonde hair hanging down around her knees, all the cats who dig striptease praying for a little breeze. Her long blonde hair falling down across her arms, hiding all the latest charms. Lady Godiva, she found fame and made her name. A Hollywood director came into town and said to her, how'd you like to be a star? You're a girl who could go far, especially dressed the way you are. She smiled at him, gave her pretty head a shake. That was Lady G's mistake. Lady Godiva, he directs Certificate X, and people now are craning their necks to see her. 'Cause she's a star, one that everybody knows. Finished with the striptease shows, now she can't afford her clothes. Her long blonde hair lying on the barber's floor, doesn't need it long anymore. Lady Godiva.
My guest, Peter Asher, as half of Peter and Gordon and their hit Lady Godiva. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We've got more with Peter Asher right after this. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. This week we're chatting with Peter Asher. He's the Peter of Peter and Gordon. He's a record producer who produced Linda Ronstadt and James Taylor and many others. And he's just written a great book called The Beatles from A to Z, An Alphabetical Mystery Tour.
Well, I grew up in Los Angeles, and I was at a benefit in, I think it was 1974, at the Troubadour that Phil Oakes was putting on, or that was a Chilean benefit. And there were a lot of great performers there. There was Jackson Browne and Phil Oakes, and Bob Lind was there. And he said, there's more to Bob Lind than the Elusive Butterfly, but as it turned out, there wasn't. And and you performed with Jeremy Clyde that night. It was one of the most marvelous things. You probably remember me because I was sitting up front.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'm sure I do. I remember this. I remember the occasion for sure.
Was that the first
time?
Yeah,
Phil was a dear friend of mine.
What was that the first time that you and Jeremy Clyde had performed as a duo?
Yes. It absolutely was. And since then, we as you probably know, since you know, Chad and Jeremy were on the road quite a bit, but then Chad retired. So Jeremy and I have actually done a couple of tours together, which is fun because I get to sing Yesterday's Gone and Summer Song, you know, that with the exception of the one night at the Troubadour, we've never done. So it was exciting.
Well, what was it? Were Chad and Jeremy and Peter and Gordon friends or rivals or what?
friends. But not so much rivals as this weird phenomenon that we continually got mistaken for each other. You know?
Right.
Because a lot of people almost thought that there really maybe wasn't two different duos. They kind of vaguely combined us in their heads, because it was a weird coincidence, you know. In each case, there was the tall, handsome one who sang the low part, and the short, nerdy one wore glasses and sang the high part. And you know, and we would get congratulated on each other's achievements because they did things we never did. Like, they were on Batman and on the Dick Van Dyke Show and these kind of serious comedy acting gigs. And people would say to us, oh, you were really good on Batman. And we'd just go, thank you, because it wasn't worth trying to explain. And when we did things they didn't get to do, we did the Ed Sullivan Show, for example, which they didn't. And people would congratulate them. And basically we realized we had no alternative but just kind of grit our teeth and go, thank you. You know, because it didn't really matter. We were, you know, we did one, all four of us did one gig together one time after Gordon and I got back together. And we were all four on stage at the same time to prove there really were two different duos. But now, sadly, there aren't. So yes. There's just one.
Yeah, in fact, when I was telling a friend of mine that I was going to be speaking to you, he said, ask him about when he was on the Dick Van Dyke Show. And I said, no, I won't.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. We were brilliant. We were really funny.
So how did you transition to record production?
That was something that was an actual ambition. In other words, the minute I was in the studio as an artist, I knew I loved the process, and I knew I really wanted to be a record producer. It was a conscious ambition on my part. So when the idea that you could hire musicians much better than yourself and tell them what to play, I thought that was brilliant. And so that was something I set out to do, to achieve, was to become a record producer. Whereas management, for example, was entirely different. That I only got into because I met and sort of discovered in the vernacular James Taylor. And after we decided to leave Apple, we just seemed logical to both of us. We didn't know who else we would trust, so that I would become his manager. And we formed a team and set off to America.
Was it your idea to put those little links between all the songs on the first James Taylor record?
Yes, it was. Yes.
I love those.
Oh, thank you. I used my friend Richard Houston, an excellent composer arranger, to write them, and it was part of an overall ambition, which in could be said to have led me to sort of overproduce the record a bit. I was just so anxious to make the record special and convince people this wasn't just another long-haired folk singer, which is what, you know, don't forget, singer-songwriters didn't exist at that point. If you had an acoustic guitar and long hair, you were a folk singer. Didn't matter if you never sang a single folk song. So I just wanted to make people pay attention and realize this was a musically important record. And those links were part of that scheme.
Something in the way she moves, or looks my way, or calls my name, that seems to leave this troubled world behind. And if I'm feeling down and blue, or troubled by some foolish game, she always seems to make me change my mind. And I feel fine anytime she's around me now. She's around me now, almost all the time. And if I'm well, you can tell she's been with me now. She's been with me now, quite a long, long time, and I feel fine. Every now and then the things I lean on, they lose a meaning, and I find myself careening in the places where I should not let me go. No, she has the power to go where no one else can find me, and to silently remind me of the happiness and good times that I know. Just got to know them. It isn't what she's got to say, or how she thinks, or where she's been. To me, the words are nice the way they sound. I like to hear them best that way. It doesn't matter what they mean. She says them mostly just to calm me down. And I feel fine anytime she's around me now. She's around me now almost all the time. And if I'm well, you can tell she's been with me now. She's been with me now quite a long, long time, and I feel fine.
The original version of Something in the Way She Moves, recorded by James Taylor for Apple Records and produced by my guest, Peter Asher. And Peter Asher is the author of a new Beatles book. It's called The Beatles from A to Z, An Alphabetical Mystery Tour.
Well, this book, it's so much fun because there's so many, I mean, I love the way you, it's so such a conversational book, and you talk to us, the reader, saying, oh, I thought I was being so smart when I used the word you in so many songs when I got to the letter U, and now here I am at Y. And...
yeah, it is conversational, that's for sure, yes.
And it brought me to my favorite Beatles trivia question that I would ask people, and then they would hate me, which is what two different songs have the same title, were both number one, and one was written by Paul and one was written by John?
Yeah, and the answer is Woman.
One of your number one hits.
Exactly, yes. Initially written, of course, by Bernard Webb, according to the documentation, because he wanted to see if he didn't have his name on a song, if it could still be successful, because people were suggesting that name alone would make hits. And so he put it out under this imaginary name, Bernard Webb, or, of course, Bernard Webb, as it became in America. And the answer is that it didn't matter. It was a hit anyway. and then the deception fell apart in about 3 or 4 weeks, but that didn't matter.
Well, let's hear it. Let's hear that song by Bernard Webb. It's number one hit for Peter and Gordon. It's called Woman.
Woman, do you love me? Woman, if you need me, let me leave me. I need you to be my woman. Woman, do you love me? Woman, you ask me how I'm doing, what shall I say? Things are okay, but I know that they're not, and I still may have lost. Woman, do you love me? Woman, if you need me, then believe me, I need you to be my woman. You'll take your time and tell me when we're alone. Love will come home. I will give up my world. You'll say that my love is my plenty of time,
plenty of time
just to get through it. Once again you'll be mine,
again you'll be mine.
I still think we can do it, and you know how much I love you. Woman, don't forsake me. Woman, if you take me, then
Peter Asher, I know you have to go, and I thank you so much for spending some time with us. And I want to ask you if you would, when you're done with your book tour and you have more time, if you'll come back and chat with us again.
Of course, I would love to. That would be great. I'd be thrilled to do so.
The book is The Beatles, From A to Z, an alphabetical mystery tour with Peter Asher. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Peter Asher, the author of The Beatles, A to Z, an alphabetical mystery tour. Thanks to Bill Graff for technical assistance on that segment. Occasionally, I drop by the Good Morning Monterey Bay program here on KSCO. Here's one of my recent visits.
In the studio with me this morning, Gary Shapiro, who is the host of From the Bookshelf. That is Mondays at 7. I almost said Saturdays at 9. I think it's becoming a bit of a joke now that I just don't remember when it's on, even though I listen to it. Now, you've listened to it.
I do listen to it, yes.
You're very good at it. You do a really good job.
Thank you.
So what have we got today, Gary?
Well, I read one of the most morbid books I ever read. I don't even know why anybody would write such a book, but at the same time, it was pretty fascinating. It's called The Show Won't Go On, The Most Shocking, Bizarre, and Historic Deaths of Performers on Stage, written by...
Oh, I love that!
Jeff Abram and Bert Kearns.
Is it a new book?
It's a brand new book.
Oh, I'm going to get a copy of that.
I think you'll like it. It's if you love death...
I do. I'm fascinated.
Well, you know, the thing is, we're alive, so I guess that's one of the things that we like about reading about other people's deaths. these are the deaths of people only who while they were performing on stage. So, like, if they finished their act and went over to the bar and died, it doesn't count. They have to die while they're on.
Who are these two people that put this together?
Well, Bert Kearns is a film and television writer and producer and director, and his co-writer Jeff Abram is a journalist and also in the book business, and I knew him as a publicist, and he said, oh, I've done a book, and so naturally I had to take a look at it. But I really liked it. It was a lot of fun. I mean, yes, it was a lot of fun.
Well, there's things you go like, oh, that's good. He died doing what he wanted to do.
Yes, there's that. You know, he died doing what he loved. He was on stage till the bitter end, including a British comedian magician who died on stage, Tommy somebody.
Oh, yes. He's the guy who's not like that, just like that. I know exactly who you mean.
Yeah, and there's actually a YouTube, they show his death that happened live on British television. Don't watch it, though, because you'll never be able to unwatch it, I found out after I watched it. but the boys who wrote it go far back into the past, into the 1500s. And any time a performer died on stage, they're interested. And some of my favorites, you know, like the great Dick Shawn, who was a wonderful comedian. I don't know if people remember Dick Shawn, but he was a fine actor and stand-up comedian. He was in the movies. He played LSD, the actor who plays Hitler in Springtime for Hitler, in the original film of the producers.
Oh, yes.
And he played Ethel Merman's beatnik son in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. He was a wonderful comedian. And he was only about 60 years old when he died on stage performing. And, you know, that was kind of a sad one because he could have given us many more years.
Yes.
Good work. On the other hand, you know, there's guys who are 99 years old and die when they're performing on stage. Or they say one last line, and the line they say is something like, you can't live forever. Then
yes. The irony.
Yeah. And there's some that are like, okay, there's a guy who... was a human cannonball, but in fact he was not a human cannonball. I mean, he had never been a human cannonball before. He was a human cannonball that one time.
And I've got to have this
things
book.
Didn't go that well for him.
No, obviously.
One of the most common ways that people die on stage is doing the bullet catching trick. Which you would think that might be dangerous. But one of the people interviewed in the book is Penn Jillette of Penn & Teller. And he says, you know, they do the bullet-catching trick like every day. And it's a trick.
It doesn't really happen.
Yeah, it's not dangerous if you do it, you know, correctly. But one of the saddest ones, where there was a magician who was about to do a bullet-catching trick, and this guy stood up in the audience and said, here, catch this one, and shot the guy. And
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have.
It's terrible. And the guy got off in court because... he had a reasonable expectation that this guy would catch the bullet because he said he could.
Wow, isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious. And what, so it's called the,
It's called The Show Won't Go On, The Most Shocking, Bizarre, and Historic Deaths of Performers on Stage by Jeff Abram and Bert Kearns. There's even Deaths on Radio, one of the great intellectuals, the king of the Algonquin Round Table was Alexander Wolcott, and he was in the middle of a radio broadcast when...
when he fell off his perch.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, but it doesn't happen while we're talking.
No, I just, I hope so too. But it'd be a good lead headline, wouldn't it?
They were talking about death when suddenly...
yes.
Linwood Barclay, and have you ever read any Linwood Barclay?
No, I love the name.
He was born in the United States, but he's a Canadian. He lived his whole life in Toronto. And he is a writer of thrillers. He's written about 20 thrillers. And many of them have been bestsellers. And he's a really good writer. The first one of his that I read was called Tap on the Window. And it's about a guy who's... there's a girl hitchhiking. And, of course, he doesn't want to pick her up because he's a married guy. And he doesn't want to have a teenage hitchhiker in his car, some beautiful teenage girl. But then she leans in and she goes, oh, aren't you Scott's father? So now it turns out that she's a friend of his son. So he picks her up. And then she has to just... stop and go to the restroom or something. And then when he finally drops her off, it turns out she's not the same girl that he picked up in his car. The one that he picked up and the one that he dropped off are two different girls.
So what happened to the first girl in the car?
Well, you have to read the book. And now, so that was the first one of his that I read. And now he's got a brand new one, and it's called Elevator Pitch. And it's a really good, entertaining, twisty thriller. And in the first prologue of the book, I'm not going to give away any of the story, but in the prologue of the book, a guy is in an elevator, and he has 15 seconds to pitch his story to this movie producer. You know, and she goes, all right, well, you've got 10 seconds now, and, you know, because I'm going to get to my floor. But then something goes wrong with the elevator. The elevator starts... it won't stop at the floor as it's supposed to, and the doors don't open, and then suddenly it just lets go and drops to the ground like 40 stories down, and everybody in the elevator is killed. That's the first thing that happens.
Holy cow!
So it's really the story of of elevators being used as weapons in New York City. And so it's a really interesting, because, you know, can you imagine if you couldn't use elevators in New York, what that would mean?
No, I can't.
And but Linwood Barclay can. That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.